What happens when you find out that the biggest longtime employer in town is ruining your drinking water?
The thing that we need to do now is to be more solution-oriented. We can't go back and change, you know, what has happened.
I'm Kara Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we continue our series on the future of the Ohio River with a look at how DuPont's legacy continues to plague the drinking water of a West Virginia community. Plus, we get a primer on which kitchen pots and pans are nonstick without the chemicals. And some snowbirds are getting mixed signals from global warming. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The Allegheny County Health Department has been so late in keeping up on its paperwork for air quality permits that three environmental groups are asking the US EPA to get involved. If it finds the county agency at fault, the EPA could withhold federal highway money or grants from the county, or take away the county's ability to regulate air emissions. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
At issue are air quality operating permits, which big pollution sources like steel mills have to get approved and then get renewed every 5 years. These permits give the public a snapshot of how much air pollution a facility will produce. Under the Clean Air Act, the county has 18 months to accept or deny these applications. But Chris Ehlers, an attorney for the Clean Air Council, says many of these applications, most of them permit renewals, have been sitting at the county for years.
The extreme examples are cases where applications have been outstanding for up to 20 years.
Ehlers' group requested the EPA file a notice of deficiency against the agency. The EPA said it's received the petition and is reviewing it. The Allegheny County Health Department said the facilities still have to comply with pollution limits even if their permits are delayed. The county says since last year, it started taking its backlog more seriously and reduced the number of pending permits. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The chemical commonly known as C8, or PFOA, have been used for decades in Teflon, fast food wrappers, and flame retardants for everyday items like clothing and carpets. It's so pervasive, most Americans likely have it in their bloodstreams. But it's toxic, and it was finally phased out last year. However, communities all over the U.S. are still grappling with the environmental fallout of C8 contamination in their water supplies. For the Allegheny Front series Headwaters, Glynis Board visited one Ohio River town where they're spending millions of dollars to meet tougher drinking water standards that public health experts say don't go far enough.
This summer, cars lined up in Vienna, West Virginia. People were picking up jugs and cases of bottled water. Their tap water had been deemed unsafe, laced with a chemical known as C8.
Yeah, what do they want? Bottles. Where at? Back? Front?
There wasn't some sudden chemical spill. The chemical company DuPont polluted the water here for decades. But the federal government says C8 levels it once allowed in the water are now considered unsafe.
Up until the EPA lowered the standard, it really wasn't an issue for us. Once they lowered the standard, then it became a problem.
That's Vienna Mayor Randy Rapp. He's talking about a new health advisory issued by the Environmental Protection Agency this year. It said C8 levels in his and other communities' drinking water are too high.
Back door.
People we spoke with in line have known about DuPont's C8 contamination for years, but they need the chemical company. For generations, it's been the biggest employer around Vienna. Many people, like resident Charles Swisher, are quick to defend them.
It's not fair to isolate DuPont, you know, as there's a lot of people doing things back a few years ago that you know, were unethical, unhealthy. The thing that we need to do now is to be more solution-oriented. We can't go back and change, you know, what has happened.
DuPont is not in charge of those solutions. It created a spin-off company, Chemours, which inherited this environmental legacy. In response to the EPA C8 advisory, Chemours is paying for installation, maintenance, and monitoring of giant carbon filters to clean drinking water. Think your Brita water filter, but on a huge scale. Vienna Mayor Randy Rapp says he has no idea how much cleanup is costing. Chemours wouldn't say, but according to the company's public documents, cleanup has already cost millions, and still the water aquifer is expected to be contaminated with C8 for hundreds of years. Not everyone is defending the company. Larry Dale grew up around this part of the Ohio River, which is commonly referred to as Chemical Valley. His father and his uncles all worked in chemical plants.
My dad told me, and I'll never forget this, find something else to do, but don't work in a chemical plant.
Dale listened. He's a school bus driver and a retired preacher, but he and his family still live in the shadow of the chemical industry.
You're on the north side of my property.
Okay. Dale stands on top of a hill next to his greenhouse and points to the next ridge over, at DuPont's landfill.
We're actually looking at a northeasterly direction. The landfill itself is that way.
This is where the company dumped over 7,000 tons of C8 sludge. It polluted streams and killed nearby livestock in the late 1990s. Concern over the contamination eventually led to a broad medical study of more than 30,000 community members, including Dale and his family.
My wife tested highest.
He doesn't blame the nearby landfill. He blames the tap water.
It's going to be with me till the day I die. It doesn't just go away.
The study of residents in this area linked C8 to a bunch of health problems, from cancer to reduced immune function. A series of additional health studies followed and further proved that chemical compounds like C8, which were buried in landfills, dumped into waterways, and blown out of smokestacks and scattered across the Ohio Valley for years, well, these chemicals are dangerous, even in small doses.
They stay in the body for a very, very long time.
Dr. Philippe Grandjean of Harvard School of Public Health is an expert on the health effects of perfluorinated chemicals like C8. His latest study looks at the long-term health effects of these chemicals on the immune system of exposed children.
If they harm the immune system today, they probably also will, you know, several years down the road. And that's exactly what we found.
Specifically, Grandjean found vaccines don't work as well in children exposed to C8 at levels similar to those found throughout the U.S. EPA officials say the C8 advisory levels were calculated to protect fetuses during pregnancy and breastfed infants, and based on the best available peer-reviewed studies. But Grandjean says the EPA's advisory doesn't go far enough. He worries it could even create a false sense of security.
I mean, if you drink a lot of that water that is permissible, many Americans are actually likely to substantially increase their body burden of these compounds.
Last year, a coalition of scientists from around the world called for limits on C8 production altogether. Health officials in New Jersey are now suggesting that C8 levels should be 5 times lower than what EPA advises. In Vienna, West Virginia, Mayor Randy Rapp just wants to get the city's water to the EPA's acceptable level.
I just try to live by whatever the rules are. And when they tell us what our water quality has to be, that is the target that we shoot for, and that's the target that we will attain.
Meanwhile, Chemours today isn't using C8, it's using a chemical replacement. Unfortunately, studies indicate that the substitute could have some of the same ecological and health effects. In Vienna, West Virginia, I'm Glynis Board.
That story comes to us from West Virginia Public Broadcasting, our partner in the Headwaters series, exploring the future of the Ohio River's vast water resources. You can hear all of the stories in the series at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Scientists are noticing something loony about this warm fall weather we've been having, and some birds that live on lakes.
Those birds will stick around much, much longer than they would if there were a freeze.
That story later on the Allegheny Front. But in the meantime, if you've been noticing anything weird or unusual about what's going on outside, iCChange.org is a ducky place to share it. Or maybe the iCChange iPhone app fits the bill. Log your observations, even upload photos, and help us trumpet stories about how climate and weather are changing our everyday lives. That's iSeeChange.org. Join the flock. Some of the residents who lived near DuPont's West Virginia plant, the one that made C8 and polluted the town's drinking water, filed a class action lawsuit because of their exposure to the chemical. Cattle that grazed in the area died, and people had health problems. Reporter Sharon Lerner wrote about the lawsuit and many other aspects of C8 in an 11-part series for the online publication The Intercept. I reached her by phone and asked about the illnesses associated with C8 that started the chain reaction leading to the eventual phasing out of the chemical.
There is a panel of epidemiologists, people who study diseases in populations, and they were approved by both sides, so by DuPont, the plaintiff's attorneys, and they were tasked with figuring out what were the probable associations between exposure to C8 and disease. And they came up with six: kidney cancer, testicular cancer, preeclampsia, high cholesterol, and thyroid disease. What they did was they looked at the population and saw that throughout the population, those who were exposed at higher rates had increases in these six diseases. Since then, and their final results came out in 2012, which was how it was set up by the lawsuit, that there are health issues connected to immunity is a big one, reproductive outcomes as well, and obesity, several things.
Yeah, you talked to one of the workers in, I believe it was the West Virginia plant, whose son ended up with birth defects, and she wondered if that was related to her time working with the C8 chemical.
Yeah, in that case, you know, it is unclear. That was the case of Sue Bailey, and her son Bucky Bailey had facial deformities, which were seen in some animal studies as well. So she had good reason to think that they might be related. And actually, the number of mothers who were pregnant when they were working in the Teflon division and had some birth defects was higher than it should have been. One of the main reasons I read about her, though, DuPont Company had this evidence and didn't share it with the EPA, which was why the agency sued the company. And it was, at the time, the agency's, you know, highest fine, the biggest fine that they had levied. And so it became the first kind of solid case of, hey, look, they have withheld important evidence about the harms of this chemical, or things that should have at least raised concern and been shared with the public.
Chemical companies are no longer producing C8 in the U.S., but now they're making something called C6, which is also known as Gen X. And some have called this a regrettable solution. Why?
I looked at the adverse incident reports, which was almost impossible to do because the identifying number that the EPA uses of Gen X was originally classified. Companies work really hard to make these things very hard to understand. It was very hard to understand, and it took quite a long time. I found that it had essentially the same constellation of health problems that were associated with C8, and that had been reported by DuPont, who was the original maker. So it's the same kind of things in lab animals, cancers, and they found effects on the liver and effects on the endocrine system as well.
I think what's so striking about your series is that there really is no way for residents near these facilities to protect themselves, or even the average consumer, to really know what they're being exposed to. It's surprising that the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't know very much about what chemical companies like DuPont are making and releasing into the environment.
Well, you know, in the case of C6, they actually did have that information. DuPont did file the adverse incident reports as they are required to by law. But what's interesting, the gap that I found wasn't that they didn't report it. It was that when they reported it, there was no clear course of action for the EPA. One would assume that they would take that information and act on it and say, hey, these are the same issues that we've seen with the other chemical. Let's do something about that. And instead, the agency that's supposed to be in charge of protecting the public from these kinds of dangers just filed them away.
So I'm just curious, you know, what your thoughts were and what your takeaways were from what you learned.
One of the most upsetting things to me about this is how big it is. At every step, I could take a step back, and I did. I kept saying, wait, but there's more. It's like you pull the string and it keeps coming. You know, this is one particular chemical, and I went deep on this particular chemical and focused in really squarely on it. But C8 is only one type of perfluorinated chemical, and perfluorinated chemicals are only one small part of the toxic, you know, chemicals that are unregulated and affecting our health and that we're exposed to all the time. And because of the way we do things here, they're out in the world way before we know what their effects are. We have to do it backwards. We have to do it after the fact and look back. That's what this has left me with, and it is upsetting.
Sharon Lerner reported an 11-story series on the chemical C8 for The Intercept. There's a link at AlleghenyFront.org. It's worth the read. So this chemical we've been talking about, C8, and its replacement chemical, as we learned earlier, are used to make Teflon and other nonstick coatings slippery, so food doesn't stick. And I thought about this a lot as I was rooting around in my cabinets for a skillet to sauté some onions for dinner the other night. Is this it? If I have a nonstick pan, should I still use it? I decided to call up an expert, Jack Bishop. He's a chef and cookbook author, and also the chief creative officer at America's Test Kitchen, where they review recipes and cookware. Hi, Jack.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
So if people have Teflon pans in their kitchen, are there health risks around those pans, and what can they do to reduce them?
We're really talking about any pan with a nonstick coating. Teflon is the most familiar, but there are other nonstick coatings. But the advice is pretty much the same for all of them, that if you're cooking at home, there are two main things you want to be concerned about. One is that coating starting to wear away, in which case it is time to buy a new pan. You really don't want that coating flaking off and ending up in your food. The bigger issue is probably making sure you don't overheat the pan. One thing that all of the manufacturers of nonstick coatings agree that is if you overheat that coating, the fumes can be potentially dangerous. In fact, there are warnings about small animals, especially birds, being kept in the kitchen for just this reason. Those fumes really are not good for you. They can induce flu-like symptoms. You do not want to be heating the pan without fat in the pan. So a lot of times people will turn on the heat when they're cooking and then add the fat later. Put the fat in there at the very beginning because the fat will start to smoke at around 400 degrees before the pan reaches a temperature of 500 or 600 degrees where it will start to put off those fumes.
What about, they call them green pans or ceramic nonstick coating? I've seen those in stores. Is that the same as the other nonstick coatings?
No, they're ceramic-based. They don't have the same sorts of issues. But the problem is they don't work very well. They're not nearly nonstick enough. You know, if you're going to be trying to fry an egg and then get that egg to come out, you have to use a lot more fat.
Yeah. For people who are concerned about nonstick pans and want to move away from them, what are good cookware options, alternatives?
I think the original green nonstick was the pan that our grandmothers probably used, meaning cast iron. Cast iron will last a lifetime if you season it properly. It's almost as nonstick as a modern nonstick pan. Plus, it browns beautifully. You can cook a steak in it. You can bake bread in it. They are incredibly durable and are making a real comeback. Sales of cast iron pans are up significantly. The big things are don't ever soak it. Never, never, never put a cast iron pan in your dishwasher. You can use a drop of soap, but don't scrub it with Brillo. And avoid prolonged cooking of highly acidic foods. You don't want to make a Sunday ragu with a can of tomatoes and let it simmer all day in a cast iron pan because it will eventually peel off that coating.
There's another alternative that America's Test Kitchen has tested out. There was a big article on it, which is...
Yeah, you know, if you've ever been in the restaurant kitchen, you notice they have these super lightweight pans that have a blackened patina on them. They are likely what's called carbon steel. It's the same thing as cast iron in the sense that they are a mix of iron and carbon. Carbon steel skillets have a lot less carbon than the cast iron pans. They can make them much thinner and lighter. So they love them in restaurant kitchens where, you know, they're picking them up and shaking food. You wouldn't really want to be working 8 hours a day on the line with a heavy cast iron pan. Carbon steel is relatively inexpensive. You do need to season it when you get it home, but you season it once and this pan will, again, last a lifetime. You can cook almost anything in it. It holds heat. It's easy to clean. We really love them.
Well, thanks so much for the advice.
My pleasure.
Jack Bishop is Chief Creative Officer at America's Test Kitchen. You can find a link to some of their other well-tested cookware recommendations at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. I can scoop up a great big dipper full of lard from the drippings can. Throw the skillet, go out and do my shopping. Be back before it melts in the pan. 'Cause I'm a woman. 2016 has been on a record-breaking warm streak, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So what does this unseasonably warm fall that we've been having mean for birds that need to start heading south? Rebecca Williams explains.
Some birds pay more attention to the weather than others. Andrew Farnsworth is a research associate with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and he's the lead biologist for BirdCast. It's a tool the lab created to forecast what's happening with bird migration each week. Farnsworth says how weather patterns affect birds varies by species. He says some birds are dramatically affected by warmer temperatures and may stick around much longer than they would otherwise.
For example, waterfowl, water birds, common loon, ducks on the Great Lakes. If temperatures are warmer than average all the way through the fall and into early winter, those birds will stick around much, much longer than they would if there were a freeze.
He says the same thing is true for some birds that live on land, like American robins. Other species are less affected by temperature. Instead, they time their trip south based on changes in the amount of daylight. Take warblers, for example, like those that breed in the forests of the Northeast and Canada.
Many of these birds are what we call calendar migrants. So they depart and arrive and time their movements on a larger scale, basically by the amount of day length there is.
But climate change can knock these species off kilter with, say, the availability of food like insects.
They can get horribly asynchronous with the resources around them. So they can depart much earlier than they might need to. They can arrive much earlier than they should in the spring. And if the prevailing temperatures are either different or more severe storms exist, there can be big problems.
Farnsworth says our changing climate is already causing some species to transition from being migrants to residents.
We've seen that in a number of places in the U.S. when it comes to, for example, Canada goose or a few other species, turkey vulture, that now are not so migratory in many places.
Farnsworth says, in general, birds are able to respond quickly to changes, but they might not be able to keep up with the pace of human-caused climate change.
It's really a wild card that depends on the species itself in terms of how climate change is going to play out.
He says some birds will probably do better in a warmer climate, and we could see their numbers go up. But he says there will likely be many species that struggle to adapt. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Last month, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional a section of the state's oil and gas law, Act 13, which lets companies take private land for some natural gas projects. That's called eminent domain. It was a unanimous decision with implications beyond Pennsylvania, and Zara Hirji reported on it for Inside Climate News. She joins me now by phone. Zara, first, why did the Pennsylvania Supreme Court rule this part of the state's oil and gas law unconstitutional? What was the rationale?
This section that I focused on essentially let companies broadly seize private land for underground natural gas storage. What their decision said is you can't assume that these kind of projects are in the public good. For a project to get the authority to use eminent domain, to take private land, means it has to be in the public good. To take private land to make money, you know, for a private purpose, they didn't see how that was in the public good. And so that's why they struck it down. But, you know, this potentially raises larger questions about what it could mean for other fossil fuel projects that similarly, you know, might be using eminent domain in the state.
Right. Your piece for Inside Climate News is largely about this decision's implications for one of the biggest pipeline projects in Pennsylvania, the Sunoco Logistics Mariner East 2. So how could that be affected?
The Mariner East 2 pipeline is what's called a natural gas liquids pipeline. So it would transport drilling products such as ethane or butane that could be used for, say, lighting fuel or heating fuel. And this is one of the few types of pipeline types that I guess state regulators have the authority to sign off on eminent domain, similar to underground natural gas storage products. And there are dozens of landowner lawsuits against this pipeline for the company's use of eminent domain. Some of the arguments that the justices make could be relevant, that the justices will kind of be able to now refer to this existing decision when they're now looking at these other cases having to do with Mariner 2 that are already working through the courts.
So this is a big win for environmentalists and property owners, right? What are the plaintiffs saying in this case?
Yeah, one of the lawyers from the case who I spoke with, John Smith, essentially said that the justices agreed with them on all of their major points. I also spoke with one of the plaintiffs, one of the town officials, where many different towns were part of this case, and he was just thrilled. There are so many different pieces of this law that were being challenged, so it's hard to kind of tie it down to any specific ruling because there is also a section having to do with doctors and restrictions that they would possibly have in terms of communicating about fracking chemicals. Mostly people are overjoyed.
Yeah. What about the oil and gas industry and other defendants in the case? Have they responded?
This was a case where the primary defendants were the different departments of the state. So environmental regulators, the state's attorney general office, the Department of Environmental Protection. So the environmental regulators said they're still reviewing the decision. The oil and gas industry, I had reached out to Senoco Logistics, for example, to see if they would be willing to comment on what this would mean for their pipeline, and they did not provide a comment.
So what do you think this decision says about eminent domain fights over pipelines or other infrastructure that are happening not just in Pennsylvania, but around the country?
You know, I spoke to a bunch of different lawyers who were part of this case and who weren't part of the case. And what they told me, looking at the justice's decision and the section on eminent domain, was many pages, you know, that they were really interested in looking at this issue. So in terms of future cases in Pennsylvania, I think there's an interest from the justices to kind of explore this issue more. As part of the larger movement, you know, this is just the latest win on eminent domain for private property owners in the country. And there are so many different fights happening, whether it's specifically on pipelines, but on other fossil fuel infrastructure projects. Activists, landowners are pushing back on these big projects in every way they can, and they're increasingly turning to eminent domain as one of the ways to do that. You know, I think a lot of environmentalists and landowners were really bolstered by the success and the people who were pushing back against TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline. You know, that's really where a bunch of landowners in Nebraska, for example, had pushed back and have been told by activists that every time there's a win in one state, it absolutely energizes them and the landowners they're working with in another state.
Well, Zahra, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Zahra Hirji is a reporter with Inside Climate News. A link to her story and a map of Pennsylvania and Ohio pipeline projects are at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. And don't forget, you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for The Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.